This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Evan Wasuka. Coming up, the arrest of Chinese nationals in Vanuatu has put the spotlight on the country's cash for passport scheme, with calls by the public for more information.
People will want to get right information, and I think that is the right of the citizens of Vanuatu to have the right information from their government.
We take a look at Australia's Pacific Labour Scheme, with one expert raising the concern over what could be a care drain in participating countries.
To be primary carers back in their home country, but they will be drawn into Australia as workers. Who's going to be looking after those children? Who's going to be looking after those elderly people?
And the biggest sporting event in the region kicks off this weekend with thousands of athletes descending on Samoa, including teams from Australia and New Zealand. It may not be a level playing field, but they're certainly being welcomed.
We don't have the same infrastructure. We don't have the same competition. So in tennis, it might take forever. But in other sports, as soon as we can include Australia and New Zealand.
But first in the program, activists lobbying for independence for the contested Indonesian region of West Papua say they are now ready to take over the country, as they've announced that three armed separatist groups have agreed to unite to form the West Papuan Army. The rebel groups have long acted unilaterally, so close observers say the development, if true, is significant, but warn it's likely to stir up tensions with Indonesia. It's claimed that the new army will come under the command of the umbrella grouping, the United Liberation Movement of West Papua. This political and diplomatic means to achieve independence for the region, a region that's marking 50 years this month since it became part of Indonesia. Jordan Fennell has the story.
They've fought for independence for the region known as West Papua after it officially became part of Indonesia following the 1969 referendum. In those five subsequent decades, though, activists have largely been divided into different groups. But in recent years, they've slowly become more united in their campaign. First, it was the political campaigners, who came together in 2014 under the umbrella group the United Liberation Movement for West Papua. And now their three military factions have come together to form the West Papuan Army. Jacob Rumbiak, a spokesman for the ULMWP, says the decision was made to help push their campaign forward.
So we, West Papua, unite in the military wing, unite in the political wing, unite in intelligence wing, unite in diplomatic wing. We will show to the Indonesian government, but also the world, that we West Papua are ready to get independent as a success country and not a failed country.
Camelia Webb-Gannon is the coordinator of the West Papua Project at the University of Wollongong. She considers it a major development as the separatist groups, which have long fought against the powerful Indonesian military, have long resisted joining the political activists.
And so that's what's significant about this, is that for the first time the ARM movement has now said we are going to answer to the political movement, the ULMWP. It's really important because they're showing, okay, we are united now. Not only are we united, but if we were to be independent, we're not going to be a military dictator. The military is going to answer to the political leaders. And, you know, I mean, that's something that Indonesia hasn't been able to achieve.
She says it also holds significance because it might change the way those within the West Papua independence campaign are perceived on the world stage.
A lot has been made out of West Papua's so-called factionalism and inability to move forward because of the political infighting. And comes from racism and stereotype of Melanesians as factionalists, that they basically can't get their act together. That's kind of the stereotype, and that's been so West Papuans have been cast in that light. But they haven't done anything on a kind of PR level to counter the bad reputation that they've had.
There have been other developments more recently. In 2015, the ULMWP was given observer status with the Melanesian Spearhead Group, the peak body focused on promoting economic growth in primarily PNG, Fiji, Vanuatu and Solomon Islands. Indonesia, though, was made an associate member at the same time because of its Melanesian population in West Papua and Papua provinces. Jacob Rumbiak, but their bid for full MSG membership will be boosted by the formation of the West Papua an army.
So this is good news to us to prepare to report back to MSG on this year, also PIF. So I think this is good for us because we took a long time, I think around 56 years, we came with this unification. statement, and I hope it can help people of West Papua to hold their voice in the international level.
However, Asia Putri Buriatri, who's a researcher at the Indonesian Institute of CIS, where she focuses on the conflict in the West Papua region, says it still won't be easy.
To be a full member of the MSG Forum, it is still not easy for the ULMWP, because we know that Indonesia as a state is now an associate member of MSG. They will influence the policies of MSG.
Dr. Webb Gannon also says the latest development could stir up tensions with Indonesia's military, which has a strong presence in the two provinces.
The armed independence movement, as soon as they can say that that is increasing its activities or is becoming more active in certain areas of West Papua or even has more of a presence in West Papua than it might previously have had, the Indonesian military will then make its presence known. It also puts pressure on the international community to then either the West Papua narrative that, yes, they can take care of themselves, that, yes, they do have the right and the ability to self-determine and to self-govern, or to hold Indonesia to account and to say to Indonesia, what are you doing? You know, why are you holding West Papuans down?
The ABC reached out to the Indonesian embassy in Australia for comment, but has not had a response.
Jordan Fennell reporting there. Meanwhile, one of the three military factions mentioned in that story has rejected the claim that it is part of a united front. A representative from the West Papua National Liberation Army said the claim is a fabrication and a lie. In response, the ULMWP has dismissed that statement, saying they represent the people of West Papua. The arrest of a number of Chinese nationals in Port Vila this week has raised questions on how they were able to obtain Vanuatu citizenship, even though they were on an international police wanted list. They were among six detained at the request of Chinese law enforcement agencies on suspicion of running an internet scam and faced deportation. The Vanuatu government is now being asked to explain the workings of its citizenship by investment policy, or cash for passport, as it's more commonly known. Liam Fox reports.
At least two of the six Chinese nationals who were arrested by local police last week had Vanuatu citizenship. Chinese law enforcement officials had requested their arrest and deportation, alleging they ran an internet fraud scam targeting people back in China. The Financial Intelligence Unit is also looking for another Chinese national, Chen Yuanyuan, who later changed her name to Liana Chen. She was granted Vanuatu citizenship in 2017, despite being wanted by Chinese authorities for alleged financial fraud. Interpol had issued a wanted notice for her in 2012. These recent events have increased concerns about the government's citizenship by investment scheme, according to Jenny Ligo from the group Women Against Crime and Corruption.
I think a lot of people felt that our identity should not be sold.
Among those to publicly voice their concerns is one of the country's founding fathers, Shem Rarua, and Chief Willie Gray Plasua, president of the Malvatu Maori Council of Chiefs.
I'm seeing a lot of statements issued by some of the paramount politicians in Vanuatu, with chiefs and with some key people in Vanuatu. But at the end of the day, they have to go back to the government.
But the sale of Vanuatu citizenship was a big issue before the recent arrests of the Chinese nationals. The government does not publicly release specific figures on how many passports have been sold and how much revenue the sales have generated. But thanks to dogged work by the Vanuatu Daily Post newspaper, we know that around 4,000 passports have been sold in recent years, most of them to Chinese nationals. And there's been a surge in sales over the last 12 months. Of the 4,000 sold in total, the newspaper estimates 1,800 of them were sold last year alone. The sale of passports has in turn caused a huge increase in non-tax revenue for the government. It's been such a big unexpected increase that in April, the International Monetary Fund warned the government to reduce its reliance on passport sales. The sheer number of passports being sold in such a small country over a short time has fueled public unease. Jenny Ligo says the government needs to address those concerns.
The Prime Minister's office or the departments or the ministry, they need to keep the right information, because Vanuatu has a law in the right to information, so people will want to get right information. And I think that is the right of the citizens of Vanuatu to have the right information from their government.
The citizenship by investment schemes are administered by the Citizenship Commission, which sits within the Prime Minister's office. Pacific Beat has sought comment from both of them.
That was Liam Fox reporting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
While Australia's newest labour program for Pacific workers aims to get more women from the region working into regional parts of Australia in industries like aged care, hospitality and tourism, there's concern that it could have unintended consequences. Some experts say the Pacific Labour Scheme risks creating what's been coined a care drain, where primary caregivers like mothers looking after young children leave their communities to work overseas. They say what's particularly concerning is the length of work contracts that can be up to 3 years and the fact that dependents aren't issued Australian visas too. But some of those taking part in the program say it's a sacrifice they're willing to make. Priyanka Srinivasan with this story.
I always said send money for, like, to help them, for my daughter and my father. Yeah, she's really proud of her mom.
Australia is keen to promote the advantages of the now year-old Pacific Labour Scheme in videos like this, particularly for women who can work in industries like agriculture, aged care and hospitality in rural parts of the country. Unlike the seasonal worker program that came before it, where workers were in Australia for just a few months at a time, workers in the PLS are able to be issued contracts and visas for up to 3 years.
It's hard, but I must make sacrifices to come here for the sake of my family.
For the last 6 months, Anne Natan Manuate from Vanuatu has been working on a banana plantation in far north Queensland as part of a one-year contract with the Pacific Labour Scheme. She has two children that she's had to leave at home with her husband, a decision that was tough.
My husband isn't working anymore, so he can look after the children. It's a sacrifice so that I can come and earn some money. It's hard. It's true that it's hard for a mum to leave her family to come here to work.
A daily chat via social media is now the way Anne Natan Manuate communicates with her children. She says she gets worried when the internet connections fail. Elizabeth Hill is an associate professor from the University of Sydney and is researching the ways in which Australia's Pacific Labour Scheme might be impacting communities and families in the home countries. She says Anne Natan Manuate's story might hint to some of the risks the program poses.
For the first time, our temporary labour scheme is formally and explicitly targeting women workers and women workers to be employed in care service or the care economy back here in Australia.
Her research is still in its early stages, but she says the scheme could create what she calls a care drain in Pacific Islands.
The age range for eligible workers is 21 to 45 year olds, and that means that many of the women who government hopes will be involved in the PLS are likely to be mothers and very likely to be primary carers back in their home country, but they will be drawn into Australia as workers. Who's going to be looking after those children? Who's going to be looking after those elderly people? Who's going to be looking after community activities?
She says it's still too early to know, but she points to evidence from other countries where similar programs have been in place.
If we look at the international research evidence, we know that temporary labour migration can have a very negative impact on families and communities left behind. It can also have some positive impacts, but there are a lot of examples in the international literature that point to failures.
Associate Professor Hill believes the government needs to develop care services in Pacific nations, things like culturally appropriate childcare and elder care in communities, to not only make sure that care gaps are covered when workers leave for Australia, but also to ensure that participants have jobs to return to once they come home.
There are opportunities for government as part of the PLS design. There's an opportunity for government to invest in care services.
Jenny Barile is from Solomon Islands Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and she says the income the workers earn makes the sacrifice worth it.
To leave one's family for 3 years is quite a significant decision for families to consider. However, in the context of Solomon Islands, this may be people's only opportunity at an employment to enable them to have an improved standard of living.
She says applicants go into the process with open eyes and are made aware of the length of time they may be away from their families.
During the recruitment process, workers are informed that they will be away for up to 3 years. And we have asked them if they have discussed this opportunity with their families and what their families have to say about being separated. If they have discussed with them how they will cope and how will they communicate while being away from each other for a long period of time.
Back in Queensland, Anne Natanmanaway from Vanuatu agrees. With the money she earns in Australia, she hopes to build up her sewing business at home.
It's a good thing, because when I was in Port Vila, Vanuatu, I never earned the sort of money I do here. It has good and bad sides to it. But it's up to each of us. If you come and behave, if you do well here, then everything will be fine.
Pacific worker Anne Natanmanaway ending that report from Priyanka Srinivasan. But the offer of good pay, much higher than can be earned back in the Pacific, can be tempting for those already with employment and potentially people with very specialised skills. There's a warning the Australian government's Pacific Labour Scheme will contribute to a brain drain, and Pacific governments and employers are being urged to wake up while the program is still in its infancy. Catherine Grau has the story.
Samoan Junior Fido is one of six men from Samoa working at an abattoir in the small regional town of Kaura. They're some of the first Pacific Islanders of just 200 so far to have signed up to the Pacific Labour Scheme since it began a year ago. But back home, Junior works in IT. He gave that job up, though, because he's now earning three times what he had been.
I was working in a phone company, and then I moved up to the Samoa Market. Samoa Market is a website. We're working together with 46 local companies in Samoa, selling their products online, and our main target was people living overseas. That's why I quit my job, yeah, because I know Aperture is better money than what I'm doing in Samoa.
And while the Pacific Labour Scheme's in its infancy, it's only been in operation for a year, Junior is by no means the first person to leave work behind in the Pacific. There have been concerns raised about those who've come to Australia to also work on farms.
I met one seasonal worker who said his previous job was an economist in the Reserve Bank.
Dr. Richard Curtin is a labour mobility specialist who used to work with Australia's Foreign Affairs Department.
Representative of the Vanuatu Tourist Business Association said he'd learnt that six cooks had been recruited the day before. And he said, we knew nothing about this. Can something be done?
For Dr. Curtin, it's clear that skilled Pacific workers are being enticed by the better pay available in Australia, although he believes it's too early on in the scheme to know the full impact.
Local salaries are not anywhere near sufficient for even people with professional qualifications to attract them.
Lionel Cullowout agrees. He's now a consultant but used to be Vanuatu's Labour Commissioner.
Most of the people who are going to the program now are people who are already in employment and already acquired skills. So it's a wake-up call for the Vanuatu government to really pull up its socks.
The Vanuatu government, like others in the Pacific, is highly supportive of the scheme, including Samoa.
We are in support of the program as long as it provides the win-win for both countries.
Lyndon Chu-Ling is the CEO of Samoa's Labour Ministry. He says the program provides them with a practical solution right now.
This opportunity is good for us,
but we are also conscious of the fact that and hope that we'll be able to balance it out in terms of not sending all of our qualified people.
And he says one way they're looking to do that is to restrict eligibility in the program to only those who are unemployed. Lionel Cullowout in Vanuatu is making the same suggestion.
I would like to see the government putting in place a form of legislation or reg that would regulate that only people who are unemployed and are looking for work would be able to engage.
But Dr. Richard Curtin believes that approach won't work.
What happens is that people either do not tell the truth or they resign from their existing job. You can't prohibit people. There are always ways they'll get around it.
Lyndon Chu Ling thinks Samoa, though, might have the solution.
We are also involving the communities, the community leaders, and also the church leaders back home. So that the ones who are registered with us, they have to provide also confirmation if they are provided the opportunity, confirmation from the mayor, villagers, and the church pastor. They have to provide confirmation that that person in writing is not employed elsewhere.
The Australian government says it's acutely aware that the PLS could contribute to a brain drain situation. Cathy Klugman is the head of strategy within its office of the Pacific.
This question of brain drain comes up occasionally, and it's certainly something that we've done a lot to address, both in the design of the program that we'll keep watching. We are dealing very closely with Pacific Island governments and the relevant agencies of government across the Pacific to maximise the benefits of the scheme and to reduce or eliminate concerns about brain drain.
Cathy Klugman from the Australian government ending that report from Catherine Grau. The biggest regional sporting event in the Pacific kicks off this weekend in Apiasa. Among those taking part in the two-week event are sportsmen and women from Australia and New Zealand. They were first invited to send teams to the games when Papua New Guinea played host 4 years ago. And now they'll be in Samoa in even bigger numbers. But given their access to more resources for training and money, is it an equal playing field? Richard Ewitt reports.
The Australian and New Zealand teams in Samoa will number more than 100 athletes between them and feature in a list of selected sports made up of taekwondo, sailing, rugby sevens, weightlifting and soccer from 2015. And this time, athletics, beach volleyball, judo and archery are also included. Australia's chef de mission, former Olympic canoeist Ken Wallace, says naturally they want to win medals, but not at all costs.
Some sports, it's a Tokyo 2020 qualifying event. Other sports, they just need to get points. Other sports, we're sending basically a junior development team. So it's a mixed bag of very professional and semi-professional athletes that are going over.
Cyril Mongi, the Secretary General of Vanuatu's Olympic Association, says the Pacific Games Council are taking a cautious approach to Australia and New Zealand's involvement, and they're right to do that.
Liaising or consulting with all the Pacific Games Association, including Australia and New Zealand, and it has been great. The mini games here, Australia and New Zealand athletes loved it, and the level of competition was much better.
Takitoa Tamopio is Cyril Mangi's counterpart with the Tongan Olympic Association, and he says the arrival of the big two can only help in creating an event that will eventually become recognised internationally.
You have an African Games, a Caribbean Games, a European Games. We don't have an Oceania Games. And there's been a drive of seeing whether we can incorporate or perhaps reconfigure the Pacific Games. In Tonga, we believe in lifting the standards by mixing with the best.
One interesting twist in the Australian team is the appearance of sprinter Melissa Breen, a former national champion and longtime rival of PNG's Queen of the Track, Toya Whistle. Ken Wallace says it's a rivalry that can inspire other members of the Australian squad.
Ultimately, we are all after that gold medal, but to see the rivalry and to see also the friendship that they can create, even though they are rivals, I think that's what we're going to celebrate more.
One potential area of controversy could come in the men's soccer tournament, where New Zealand are being allowed to field an under-23 team. At least one coach in the Pacific has voiced concern over the move, as giving the All Whites an advantage ahead of the Olympic qualifying tournament in Fiji in September, where all teams will be at under-23 level. But Siromagi says rather than complain about the situation, the Pacific nations in the soccer tournament should embrace it.
We should be more positive about it and say it's great that New Zealand is coming with the under-23 team and will make the competition much more interesting.
Where the problem lies in the Pacific Games becoming the Oceania Games is that while some sports have the potential to compete with Australia and New Zealand on equal terms now or certainly in the medium term, others like Siromagi's sport of tennis will probably never achieve that kind of standard.
We don't have the same infrastructure. We don't have the same competition. So in tennis, it might take forever. But in other sports, I think the sooner we can include Australia and New Zealand, and I think in some of the sports they include the juniors, I think we should start that way and continue to improve, definitely.
Be they Pacific or Oceania Games in the future, Takitoa Tamopio would love to see his country, Tonga, play host one day. It's a sad time for sport lovers in the Friendly Islands who should have been welcoming athletes from across the region to Nuku'alofa next week if the Pohiva government hadn't pulled the plug.
That's Richard Ewitt ending that story. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Osuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from around the Pacific.